Christians and State by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. Some tensions between Christianity and various secular governments today are sketched, followed by a detailed discussion of the biblical teaching on government. The Old Testament background is surveyed, then several major New Testament passages, and lastly a number of New Testament examples on the interaction of believers with government. Some suggestions are made for how Christians today should interact with their governments. This is a time of increasing tensions between Christians and the government, local government, state government, federal government. Some of these tensions in the United States involve public schools versus Christian schools for a declining number of students, a declining student pool. Question of state oversight of Christian schools. Question of tax exemption for Christian organizations. Matter of prayer and Bible reading in public schools. A matter of religious interest groups using public school property. And the growing pluralism in the United States with pressure for gay rights and such. There are two major areas of concern, I think, for Christians in these matters. The first one is, what is the right thing to do in each of these cases of tension? And the second is, who is authority and how much authority? In this talk, we want to concentrate on this second area here, who has authority and how much. And the question of the right thing to do in each of these cases would be reserved for various PowerPoint talks on those subjects, some of which I've done something with and some of which I haven't. What does the Bible have to say about the relationship of believers to the state? What we want to do first is look at Old Testament background. Then we'll look at the New Testament teaching and some New Testament examples. And we started with creation, as described for us in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. Here we see that God has created both earth and mankind, and so God owns both earth and mankind, but to use them as he sees fit. Humans, then, do not absolutely own themselves or anything else, but we as humans hold these things as property and trust from God. We're kind of managers, if you like. This biblical view contrasts quite strongly with statism, in which the state is viewed as having absolute authority, but it also contrasts with individualism, in which individual has absolute authority over his or her property. At the beginning of the book of Genesis, we see some examples of what I call God's worldwide covenants. That is, covenants or promises or contracts or agreements which God has made with the whole of the human race. We'll move on later to those specific ones which he made with his people Israel. But the first of these is what we call the Adamic covenant, the covenant which God made with Adam and Eve, etc. And this is sketched for us in Genesis 1:28, and more particularly in Genesis chapter 2:15 through 25. We see here that mankind is given authority over the earth, over plants and animals. We see also that some sort of family authority is also established. After this, we have what we call the fall of the human race, in which Adam and Eve rebelled against God's or covenant which he had made with them, and bring upon themselves rather disastrous consequences. We understand as we read over this material that the fall did not nullify this worldwide covenant, this disposition, but it did make it more difficult. Here, with the fall of the human race, and as that is narrated then in the chapters following, we see the origin of human authority, the origin of human property, and the origin of crime. There's nothing here explicit on government beyond the family. We move on in Genesis 9 and following to what we call the Noachian covenant, the covenant between God and Noah made in connection with the flood. In chapter 9, verses 1 through 17, as we read over that covenant, we see that this covenant apparently extends man's authority over other humans when compared with cases earlier of Cain's behavior and Lamech's behavior. Mm-hmm. It looks like, in the Noachian covenant that some sort of government is instituted with the power of life and death to punish sin. This may be of an informal sort of community sort, but it does look like we've got something of that sort of happening. We want to speak just a bit about God's limitations on mankind as seen in these covenants. They can be seen, first of all, in God's judgments. The flood is brought upon mankind in Genesis 6 through 8 for what we might call general wickedness and the disruption of human languages at Babel in Genesis 11, we are told, is for specific wickedness of pride and disobedience. A refusal of humans to scatter out over the earth and a desire to make a name for themselves, if you like. We see also God's judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis chapter 18 and 19. And here, in those passages and some remarks in Ezekiel, we see that the judgment of God here is for the great wickedness of the people in these cities, for sodomy, that is, unnatural sexual behavior, and for misuse of wealth. We also have a picture here of what we might call the protective function of the righteous, that just as God had rescued a family, or the family of Noah, from the flood, so here he rescues a family from Sodom and Gomorrah, the family of Lot. And there's this whole bargaining session between God and Abraham in which God is finally bargained down, we might say, to agree that if 10 righteous people can be found in Sodom and Gomorrah, then these cities will be spared. So a picture of a functional, the protective function of righteousness. If there are enough righteous people in a particular society, God may indeed spare that society from judgment and disaster. Another way we can see God's limitation on mankind by means of these covenants is to look at how mankind is denounced by the prophets. And we here select out from the large amount of material that we have in the prophets, that specifically that is directed against the Gentiles. One of the striking examples of this is in the first chapter or so of the book of Amos, where we have prophecies of judgment against various nations. There is a judgment against the city-state of Damascus for threshing Gilead, some kind of a figure of speech for the oppression and violence which the Damascenes did against the inhabitants of the territory south of them, but still east of the Jordan River, which we call Gilead. Then there's a denunciation against Philistia, the Philistines, and Tyre, the Phoenician city-state, for deporting populations from an area, presumably when they conquered that area. There's denunciation against the nation of Edom for its warfare, for its cruelty, and for its vengeance in these activities. There's a denunciation against Ammon, the Ammonites, for their aggression and their atrocities which they commit. There's judgment against Moab for murder and desecration of bodies, here speaking of the burning of the king that they conquered to lime, so burning his body, if you like, desecration of his body. That passage also contains denunciations against the northern kingdom Israel and the southern kingdom Judah, but that is out of the context of our discussion here, which is God's limitations on mankind in general in these covenants. But another example of denunciation by the prophets is the denunciations of Jonah and Nahum against the Ninevites, that is, against the Assyrian Empire, whose capital city was Nineveh. And here the denunciation is for their wickedness, for their enmity towards God, for their afflicting Judah and other nations, so what we might call oppression, atrocities, imperialism, if you like. We have denunciation by Daniel on the Babylonian kings, denunciation of Nebuchadnezzar and the judgment brought on him for his pride, his thinking, is not this the great Babylon which I have made, etc., ignoring the fact that the God who is writing the story of human history has in fact allowed Nebuchadnezzar to conquer these various nations. And then the disaster that comes upon Belshazzar, co-ruler with his father Nabonidus at the end of the Babylonian kingdom, for his pride and for his mocking God and taking the gold and silver serving dishes and such that had been used in the temple and having a banquet with them. Well, that's God's covenants with mankind, and the fact that God is obviously holding these nations responsible for their behavior and holding them to some kind of a standard, which we could work out by looking at what the various sins are that are being rebuked. We turn, however, now to God's covenants with Israel. The previous covenants were made with all people. We might view them then as being still in force, even where the gospel has not penetrated, since these were made with the various nations. The following covenants, God's covenants with Israel, however, apply to restricted groups, Israel, and then the New Testament to the church, though they will probably be broadened during the thousand-year reign of Christ that I understand is to take place when Jesus returns to this earth. The first of these God's covenants with Israel is the one we call the Abrahamic, the one which God makes with Abraham, and this is sketched for us in Genesis chapters 12 through 22. No explicit form of government is established at this point. God is making a covenant with an individual and then with his descendants, and they have not reached a large enough size to need anything bigger than a family government, I guess. Promises of blessing are developed, however, that God will bring blessing upon Israel and through them will bless the nations, if you like. The next covenant is what we call the Mosaic covenant, the covenant which God makes through Moses with the Israelite nation, which has now become a nation and which has just been rescued from their slavery in Egypt. And this is sketched for us in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Here, the offices of prophet, priest, and king are established, and it's made fairly clear that the latter two offices, priest and king, are to be kept separate. The prophet, according to Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 22, is chosen by God individually. We'll see this in contrast to the priest and king. And the prophet is to be put to death if he is a false prophet, that is, falsely claiming to be a spokesman for God, or if he is misusing a real authority he has. This being put to death is presumably to be done by the government, and the function of the prophet, among other things, is to act as advisors to the government. The office of priest we see sketched for us most specifically in Exodus 28 and 29, though a good deal said elsewhere, is chosen by God as a dynasty. That is, it will be Moses' brother Aaron and his descendants, not Moses' descendants, not just any descendants, but the male descendants through the male line of Aaron. Chosen by God as a dynasty. They are clearly specified by law that they are supposed to do this or that sort of things. It's not clear exactly who is to enforce their doing these sorts of things. And the priests basically have virtually no government functions. I might argue that they have perhaps some function in the direction of occasionally giving advice by means of using the Urim and the Thummim, and that they have some educational responsibilities as well. Thirdly is the office of the king, and this is sketched for us most clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 17. The priest too, the king too, is chosen by God. At the point of Deuteronomy 17, this office is to be set up by the people later, and it will not really become a dynasty until under the Davidic covenant, but that's rather quick. The first king turns out to be Saul, and he is succeeded ineffectively by his son, one of his sons, but David had already been selected by God to succeed Saul, and he's the one who then becomes king in place of Saul's group, and then his descendants will continue to rule in the southern kingdom until the destruction of that kingdom in 587 B.C. So the king is chosen by God, becomes a dynasty under the Davidic covenant. There are restrictions on the activities and such of the king. Restriction regarding race, he must be an Israelite. Restriction regarding military power, he is not to multiply horses to himself. That was perhaps the major military animal, if you like. He was not to multiply wives. Obviously, this had some sexual connotations, but a major point as far as kings were concerned on multiplication of wives was they were a means by which treaties were made. One would marry the daughter of some other king or something of that sort, and it made a treaty between the two kings, if you like. So restriction on that, and then restriction on the king's wealth. The last three of these, I think, the military power and the horses, if you like, the wives and the wealth, basically are intended to suggest that the king is not to get his security from military power, alliances, or money. His security is to come from doing what God wants and trying to align his own agenda with God's agenda. The period of the judges, which intervenes after the time of Moses, and the early time when the Israelites are in the Promised Land, suggests some ambivalence regarding the form of government. As we read through the material of Judges, it becomes apparent that initially God is to be viewed as the king of Israel, and so they will have no human king. But later, when the Israelites become dissatisfied with that, God allows them to have a king, but he is going to make the choices there. And that tension kind of then runs through the Old Testament and the covenant with Israel. Under these, under this Mosaic covenant, it's interesting to look at the interaction of various individuals with these particular officers, or their interaction of these officers with each other. For instance, the interaction of the individual and the king, or the individual, the ruler. In Judges chapter 3, a foreign ruler, Eglon, has taken control of Israel and is oppressing them, etc., and God calls up a judge by the name of Ehud, and basically Ehud goes and assassinates Eglon. So we have a picture, if you like, of a God-ordained assassination, we should say. The interaction between David, who has been secretly anointed to become king, and Saul, who had previously been anointed and is now serving as king, is sketched for us in 1 Samuel 18 through 2 Samuel 2, so a long period of time. And we see that David recognized that God had chosen Saul as king and did not think then that he had the right to assassinate Saul or rebel against Saul or anything of that sort, and yet he obviously ran away from Saul when his own life was threatened by him and did not feel it necessary to stay around and let Saul kill him. That's an interaction there, huh? Contrast this with the activity of the Syrian Hazael, sketched for us in 2 Kings 8, when he learns from one of Israel's prophets that he is to become king and succeed his current master, who is king of Syria. He takes things into his own hand and basically assassinates the king by the king being sick at this point by wetting a cloth and strangling, suffocating the king with that. So a very different picture than the David, who a couple of times turns down an opportunity in which could easily have assassinated Saul. Interaction of the king and the prophet we see in several cases. In Rehoboam, Solomon's son and his successor as ruler, we see in 1 Kings 12 that the northern kingdom, the northern tribes have revolted against Rehoboam, and Rehoboam is calling together his army to go put down that revolt. When a prophet shows up, and the prophet says, "This is from God. You are not to go up into the northern tribes and bring them back to your obedience." And Rehoboam obeys the Israelite, the Jewish, the Judahites with him, who are under his authority, obey as well. It's an example of a king obeying a prophet in that case. On the other hand, in the same generation, we have the fellow Jeroboam, who had been predicted by one of the prophets face to face that he would become king of the northern tribes. He does become king of the northern tribes, and yet he's worried about his security, and so to protect his security, he modifies the worship of his nation so that they won't be going down to Jerusalem to the temple to worship. And in 1 Kings 13, we see an example of resistance. God sends a prophet up to Jeroboam and prophesies against Jeroboam and against the worship site at Bethel, which Jeroboam has set up. And we see an example of Jeroboam resisting the prophet. And it's not until the prophet brings a disaster on Jeroboam's own hand, arm that shrivels up and becomes paralyzed that Jeroboam backs off of trying to have the guy arrested and killed. And Jeroboam does still conduct the rest of his kingship, if you like, in a rather different sort of behavior, in which he has modified the worship of God in the northern kingdom. In the rule of Ahab, a couple of centuries later, sketched for us in 1 Kings 22, we see a prophet comes and tells Ahab and his advisors, and in fact the southern king as well, Jehoshaphat, that if Ahab does in fact go to war against his opponent across the Jordan River, that he in fact will die in that situation. And Ahab basically says, well, put this prophet Micaiah in prison and feed him just bread and water until I return. And the prophet Micaiah says, if indeed you return, the Lord has not spoken by me. Pay attention, Israel, to what I am saying. So we have an example of the testing of the prophet. Israel was, in fact, responsible to test prophets to see whether they were telling the truth. And within a few days, it became clear that Micaiah was the one speaking from God and not the prophets of Baal that Ahab had, who were prophesying great victory for Ahab, because Ahab is, in fact, defeated in the battle and loses his life. In 2 Chronicles 24, we have an example of the King Joash, southern king, who actually has a prophet put to death. And so we see interaction between a king and prophet as well. The picture we get here, I think, is that the prophets have moral authority over against their political rulers, but they will sometimes be obeyed, they will sometimes be resisted, they will sometimes be ignored, and they will sometimes be killed. What about interactions between king and priest? Well, we see the situation of Uzziah and Azariah, Uzziah the king and Azariah the priest in 2 Chronicles 26, where Uzziah decides that he wants to go into the temple and offer incense, and Azariah says, no, that is something which only the priests are to do. Uzziah pushes on to do it anyway, and Azariah is about to have his priestly associates try to resist by force, which would no doubt have led to considerable bloodshed in the temple precincts. But Uzziah is struck with leprosy, and as soon as he realizes what happened, he then voluntarily bails out. So a confrontation between king and priest in which God's miraculous intervention solves the situation there. In the case of Athaliah and Jehoiada in 2 Kings 11, Athaliah has usurped the kingdom when her son has died and has killed off the grandchildren, though she missed one, she did not realize, and has now been ruling for several years. And Jehoiada, the high priest, realizes that, in fact, one of the grandsons has survived and that he is the rightful ruler. And as he reaches an age of, what, about 8, I believe he is, Jehoiada organizes a rebellion with the temple guards, in which the child is proclaimed king. And Adaliah, when she comes in and tries to stop this, shouting rather ironically, treason, rather ironic for someone who has killed most of the royal family to assert power, Jehoiada has the temple guard take her out and have her put to death. So, that's a little sketch of some of the interactions between these. We see there are some tensions between the religious authorities and the political authorities and such. We have some proverbs in Scripture which tell us how things ought to run, if you like, and take into account basically what common sense dictates and what the Scripture dictates, but doesn't always take into account what will happen under persecution and that sort of thing. And we have proverbs there on duties. We have proverbs about duties of the king. We see some of these in Proverbs 16:10 through 15, Proverbs 25:2, Proverbs 29, various verses 4, 12, 14, Proverbs 31, verses 2 through 9. Then we have some proverbs on the duties of the citizen, and we see these in chapter 16, verses 13 and 14, chapter 20, verses 2, chapter 25, 15, chapter 24, 21 and 22, chapter 25, 6 and 7. So let's have a look at each of those. Duties of the king, Proverbs 16, 10 through 15, reading here from the New International Version. The lips of a king speak as an oracle, and his mouth should not betray justice. Honest scales and balances are from the Lord. All the weights in the bag are of his making. Kings detest wrongdoing, for a throne is established through righteousness. Kings take pleasure in honest lips. They value a man who speaks the truth. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, but a wise man will appease it. When a king's face brightens, it means life. His favor is like rain cloud in the spring. If we walk back through that and look at that a little bit, the first one, I think, is basically saying that the king's word is law, if you like, and is to be kept, and has even a religious authority in some sense, but he should therefore speak what is just and not in any way betray justice. That the whole thing of honest weights and measures, if you like, are what God wants in the way of how a kingdom should operate, so presumably the king is to support that sort of thing. Kings are to detest wrongdoing, and if they themselves are righteous and encourage righteousness, that will tend to establish their thrones. They especially need honesty. How can you run a government if you listen to liars all the time, huh? And a king's anger is a dangerous thing, and so it's wise to try and respond to that properly, if you like. And it's good to seek the king's favor. So it's looking at a whole constellation of ways in which a king should rule, and basically the idea is with justice, with honesty, and with punishment of wrongdoing and encouragement of righteousness. So the picture we see here is that the king has a divine commission. He is to be concerned with truth, and he is to be concerned with punishing the right people, not the wrong people. Here's some others. Proverbs 25:2. It's the glory of God to conceal a matter. To search out a matter is the glory of kings. Well, glory in these is perhaps it might be a picture of that which distinguishes God from other people, that which distinguishes kings from other people. And one thing about God is he does things that often are unknown when they occur, or secret when they occur, or something. And perhaps a king might do that as well. But this proverb actually emphasizes the responsibility, the thing that makes kings what they ought to be, is the getting to the bottom of things. A king, remember, is not only an executive and a legislature, but he's also a judge, and to find out who is really in the right in various criminal judicial things is something that a good king ought to do. Proverbs 29:4, by justice a king gives a country stability, but one who is greedy for bribes tears it down. A king who cares about justice is going to produce a good situation in the country, but a king who is willing to bend the truth, bend justice, etc., in order to get money out of it, is going to tear down the country's stability. Proverbs 29:12, a ruler listens to lies, all his officials become wicked. Rather striking to see how these things actually have worked out in human history. And basically here they're given as duties of a king. You want to have a kingdom that's a pleasant one for people to live in, and you want to have a reign that's going to be remembered with appreciation after you're gone. These are the kind of things you need to do. Proverbs 29:14, if a king judges the poor with fairness, his throne will always be secure. Doesn't mean there'll never be assassinations, etc., but a king who judges the poor with fairness is one who is going to have widespread support then within his society, and that will add to security of his situation. And here's another one, Proverbs 31, verses 2 through 9. It's in things that were told to King Lemuel by his mother. O my son, O son of my womb, O son of my vows, do not spend your strength on women or your vigor on those who ruin kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink wine, not for rulers to crave beer, lest they drink and forget what the law decrees, and deprive all the oppressed of their rights. Give beer to those who are perishing, and wine to those who are in anguish. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of those who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly, defend the rights of the poor and the needy. Well, here, this mother is pictured as advising her son, who is king, on what he ought to be doing, and he ought to be concentrating on his responsibility as king, not giving himself to womanizing, okay? This is not an anti-feminist passage. And not giving himself to booze that will in fact take away his common sense, if you like, and his fairness, etc. It goes on, verse 8 and following, concerned that you're to the king is to defend those who can't defend themselves, those who are economically disadvantaged. The king is to protect them from oppression by those who are wealthy, etc. So, picture of the duties of the king. Moving on to the duties of the citizen, we see these in Proverbs 16:13. Kings take pleasure in honest lips. They value a man who speaks the truth. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, but a wise man will appease it. It basically says, you're a citizen, you should speak the truth. You should not be a liar. And the things being equal, and that's the way the Proverbs work, kings will appreciate you if you speak the truth. Okay? It is possible to get on the wrong side of a king, and he gets angry at you. You need to think of a right way as a citizen to try and appease that, not to encourage rebellion, if you like. Proverbs 22, a king's wrath is like the roar of a lion. He who angers him forfeits his life. Basically saying a citizen should use some common sense in regard to the dangers of getting a king angry at him, and should try and do, again, within the range of what is right, those things that would appease that. Proverbs 25:15, through patience a ruler can be persuaded, and a gentle tongue can break a bone. A citizen has a responsibility of patience, persuasion, gentle speech, etc. Proverbs 24:21, fear the Lord and the king, my son. Do not join with rebellious, for these two will send sudden destruction upon them, and who knows what calamities they can bring. Here, the son is being urged to fear God, okay? rather than rebel against him, to fear the king rather than rebel against him, because both of these are powerful individuals. God is running the whole show. He's writing the story. It's totally idiotic to rebel against God, if you like. And given the power of a king over against the power of average or even very wealthy subjects, it's very foolish to rebel, and you will wind up getting yourself destroyed by king. Doesn't mean there's never a time to rebel, but this is the general picture of things. Proverbs 25, 6 and 7. Do not exalt yourself in the king's presence. Do not claim a place among great men. It's better for him to say to you, come up here, than for him to humiliate you before a nobleman. A picture here rather similar to one that Jesus has in one of his parables in Luke 14. But the picture is that humility is the right kind of behavior for a citizen, not being a braggart, etc. Let your reputation, let your behavior commend you to the king, rather than your being a person who puts himself forward and finally gets humiliated by the king when he sees that you are in fact a braggart and not someone who has actually got those abilities that you're claiming. Well, that's a kind of a fast tour of Old Testament teaching regarding government. We move now to the New Testament teaching, and we'll look first of all at basic passages and then come back and look at some specific examples. A very basic passage is Matthew 22, 15 to 22. In the middle of a situation in which the opponents of Jesus are seeking to discredit him, we have this incident. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know you're a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. And all of this that the Pharisees have said is in fact true, but they're basically trying to set up a trap for Jesus. Tell us then, they say, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Well, they're trying to get him to make a public statement about something that is pretty dangerous politically to speak out on. Taxes to Caesar, obviously something that Caesar was going to very jealously guard, but something which are not going to be popular in a society in which Caesar's basically conquered Israel and is viewed as an oppressor and an invader, if you like. Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius, silver coin, perhaps about the size of our dime, but about twice as thick, and made of real silver at that time. And he asked them, show me a coin used in paying tax. They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose portrait is this, and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. When they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and went away. A little background in the passage here. Palestine was conquered by the Romans in 63 BC, so by the time this incident takes place, Jews have been under Roman rule for about a century. The rule has typically been indirect, initially through a governor named Antipater, and then through his son Herod the Great from 37 to 4 BC. And then one of his sons for about 10 years, and then after that a series of Roman governors. So they've been under Roman rule for about nearly 25 years by the time, Roman governors for about 25 years by the time this event takes place. They're currently under the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, who was not particularly popular at the time. It'll turn out that he's actually one of the milder governors a generation later, but not obvious at this point. Pilate had gotten on the wrong side of the Jews by trying to bring his Roman standards kind of metal placards, which the Romans carried kind of instead of our modern flags, in which there was image of the Roman emperor and often images of some of their gods on them, and were viewed as blasphemous by the Jews, had tried to bring them into the city of Jerusalem. And then Pilate later had appropriated some of the temple money, the treasury, money in the treasury, to build an aqueduct, which had the purpose of bringing water into Jerusalem, and particularly bringing water into the temple for cleansing the animals, etc., in connection with sacrifices, but was not well received by the Jews. And then an occasion, which we don't have further information on here, but mentioned in the Gospels, in which he apparently had killed some Galileans while they were in the midst of offering sacrifices in the temple. My own guess would be that Pilate was aware that these particular Galileans were planning, or perhaps had even been involved in, some kind of rebellion. Maybe they were some kind of guerrilla forces or terrorists, and Pilate had killed them, etc. So he had done a number of things that had gotten the Jews very angry with him, and he will eventually be deposed by the Roman emperor for some of these kind of behaviors. Further background on the passage, the Jews' views on the relationship to the Roman government covered a fairly wide spectrum. The Sadducees and the Herodians, who show up in this particular incident, were in favor of cooperating with the Romans, though they perhaps were not too happy about that kind of government and would have preferred something else. The Sadducees, I think, would have preferred that they themselves rule the place as kind of a temple state, if you like, since the Sadducees were connected with the priesthood. The Herodians, apparently from their name, we don't know much else about them, would have preferred that one of the Herods, one of the descendants of Herod the Great, would rule the country, though in fact what was now going on is a Roman governorship. The Pharisees, who perhaps had the widest public support, were inclined towards rather grudging obedience to Rome, but some concern about Romans carefully watching their steps and not treading on religious sensibilities. Another group, which we call the Zealots, some of them were called the Sicarii, were those who advocated revolt against Rome. And they will eventually win out and get a full-fledged revolt against Rome that begins in 66 A.D. and becomes more and more radicalized, but finally winds up in the destruction of the Jewish state in 70 A.D. All of this is a generation of future at the time this incident, the passage, takes place. The passage is obviously about the whole question of Roman taxation, so we should say a word about this. Roman taxation was pretty high, not very high perhaps compared with some of the taxation that we have today, except that the people were all, at least poor people, were much closer to the poverty line. It was an imposed taxation. Our taxation is voted upon in one way or another, but there certainly was not. And there was a good deal of government corruption, so a great deal of money that was raised never really made it to the purposes for which the taxation was ostensibly raised to support the army, to protect the citizens from one another and from criminals and that sort of thing, from invasion. But not much of it actually wound up in those ways, but basically supporting the lifestyle of the upper crust in Jewish society, and then a great deal of it going off to Rome to support the lifestyles of the emperor and such. The coinage, we are looking here at a silver coin. The copper coins had fairly carefully avoided having any human images on them, although we believe from the coinage existing in the governorship of Pontius Pilate that we did have some coins which perhaps had some pagan symbols on them. Some uncertainty on that, but that's the general view of scholars at this particular point. But this particular coin had an image of the emperor Tiberius on it, who would be reigning emperor at this time, and a reference to him on the inscription of being the son of the divine Augustus. So some theological claims and just the whole picture of image. And of course, if he's son of the divine Augustus, then there's some idea perhaps of even worshiping the image on the coin, all of which things would certainly have stuck in Jewish the throats of those Jews who were at all pious. So here's the dilemma posed by Jesus' opponents in order to put him on the spot. Jesus going to say that, yes, we should pay these taxes? Then the opponents could charge him with collaboration with the Romans, with condoning the emperor's claims, and that would lead to Jesus being discredited with the crowd. On the other hand, if Jesus says, no, you should not pay your taxes, then his opponents could charge him with treason, and he would certainly be discredited with the government, and since he is a public and popular teacher, it would be quite dangerous for him to say anything of that sort, since the Roman officials would surely have him arrested and put to death for something of that sort. So that's the dilemma posed by Jesus' opponents. If he says, yes, pay taxes, he's going to be discredited with the crowd. If he says, no, don't pay taxes, he's going to be discredited with the government in danger of getting killed. Jesus' answer starts with an action. He gets his opponents to supply the coin. And when they do that, they have essentially lost the argument that they don't know it yet, because since they have won, they've left themselves open and demonstrated hypocrisy. What are they doing with this coin that has got this pagan image on it and got these pagan claims on it? And then Jesus tells them, on the basis of Old Testament law, that since the coin belongs to Caesar, they have Caesar's property, and they have a responsibility to give it back to him. When you've been loaned something by someone, you have a responsibility to repay that loan. Well, that's Jesus' response. And by slipping between the horns of the dilemma, he has not only outwitted his opponents, but he's also given us some important teaching on government. Two spheres are clearly indicated in Jesus' response. Get back to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and give to God what belongs to God. So the two spheres are not the temple and God, or the temple and Caesar, or the priesthood and Caesar. They're God and Caesar. The relationship between God and Caesar is not indicated, and we'll see some of that further on in other New Testament passages. Are they separate from one another? Does God's sphere include government? I think we would certainly think so from what the Old Testament has already taught us. So notice Jesus' terminology, God and Caesar, rather than temple and Caesar, priest and Caesar, or something of that sort. Clearly, Jesus teaches a responsibility both to God and to Caesar. He does not, however, teach equality of authority. He hardly pictured God as excluded from Caesar's sphere, or Caesar's authority is somehow equal to that of God's authority. Well, that's the teaching, I think, of that passage in Matthew. Another second passage is Romans 13, verses 1 through 7. And here's what Paul says. He's speaking here to Gentiles, but the Christians who are living in Rome, and so not only under the Roman authority, as would be anyone living in the Roman Empire, but especially close to the emperor, if you like. And Paul says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rules hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. You want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it's necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience.
This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. Revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. We see here in verse 1 that God is the source not only of authority in general, but of every particular authority as well. This is not only the whole kind of system that exists in the world has God as its source, but God, by his providential control of history, has actually allowed this or that ruler to come to authority as well. Verse 2, therefore we disobey God in resisting authorities. And this also can be seen to have some qualifications further on, but it basically says God didn't set you up to be ruling the planet, to be ruling the society, be ruling this particular state, if you like. God allowed this particular person who is now ruling to be ruling, and so we disobey God in resisting these particular authorities. Verses 3 and 4, government authority is intended to limit evil and succeeds. I'm not dealing here with the problem that the governors may not be all that we should wish them to be, or even God would wish them to be. God, in, if you like, writing the story as the author of history, does not mean that God does not write into it people who are very unsatisfactory in various ways, just as a good author, say J.R.R. Tolkien, might not write some bad characters into the story. And he's saying government authority serves God by rewarding righteous people and punishing wicked people. And a government has to be in pretty terrible state in which it only rewards wicked people and only punishes righteous people. There have probably been virtually no governments on earth that have ever quite managed that. So it does limit evil in a successful way. Verse 5, therefore we submit both to obey God and to avoid government punishment. Verses 6 and 7, we must pay taxes, even tribute money to the government, respect its officers, and submit to them. That is to say, this is our responsibility before God. 1 Peter 2, verses 11 through 17, we now have the Apostle Peter speaking. Dear friends, he says, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that although they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men, whether to the king as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish men. Live as free men, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the brotherhood of believers. Fear God. Honor the king. Well, in verses 11 to 12, the apostle tells us that we are strangers here on earth, okay? That because we have trusted in God, we have become people who are looking forward to that city that lies beyond this life, etc. So we must resist living like natives, living as though we're still basically sinners. We are to have a beautiful lifestyle. Verses 13 and 14, this lifestyle involves submission to government authorities for God's sake, as they are intended to reward the righteous and punish the wicked. So we see Peter giving us the same picture that Paul does here, and part of our lifestyle of living for God and being transformed by him is involves submission to government's authorities for God's sake. God's purpose for this is to put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. There are people who would like to see Christianity subversive. There were certainly plenty in the Roman Empire and New Testament times, and there have been plenty throughout history. And God's purpose of having us as Christians submit to government authorities is to put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. He didn't put us in the world primarily to run the place,
but primarily to be a testimony the people around us. Verse 16 and 17 is a summary. Don't use your Christian freedom as a pretext for wickedness. Honor all, love Christians, fear God, honor the king. Peter's writing this at a time when the Roman Empire is ruled by what we now call an emperor, but which in the Greek language at the time was called the king. So he is actually referring to the Roman emperor here, though it's more general than that. And of course, the emperor at the time Peter's writing is not a great guy. He's Nero. He probably has not shown all of his wickedness by the time Peter is writing 2 Peter 2, but it will show up fairly soon. Peter himself will be put to death by the authority of this person, and yet still we are to do this. Well, we need to move on. We're running low on time here on our digital recorder, so we want to look at the New Testament teaching regarding some specific examples. And the first one we pick out is John the Baptist and Herod Antipas in Mark 6. John, as a prophet, publicly rebukes a political leader, but John makes no attempt to organize revolt, though perhaps Herod Antipas, would, being rather paranoid, might have seen some dangers there. And John will get himself put to death by Herod Antipas for his public rebuke. And yet, in serving God, he takes consequences. In Acts 4 and 5, we have Peter and John versus the temple authorities. And Peter and John refuse to obey the authorities when the authorities forbid what God demands. That is the preaching of Jesus. But they take the consequences rather than organize a revolt. And again, we see nonviolent resistance by believers, if you like. In Acts 23, we have a picture of Paul in the Jewish Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin. Paul seems to be uneasy about his remarks to the high priest and his splitting the Sanhedrin by setting the Pharisees against the Sadducees. Paul's uneasiness perhaps suggests a responsibility to show respect even when the rulers don't deserve it. We have Paul and the Roman governor Felix in Acts 24, and here Paul, on trial for his life, appeals to evidence, appeals to witnesses, and he uses his opportunities to present the gospel. He apparently refuses to pay a bribe to the Roman governor, although the governor would have liked that. The governor is not as up and up a ruler as one might like. In Acts 25, we see Paul's interactions with Felix's successor, Festus, who is now the Roman governor. And again, Paul on trial appeals to evidence. He admits the right of the tribunal to put him to death, and he makes use of the available legal remedies, which in this case, because Paul is a Roman citizen, allows him to appeal to Caesar when the Roman governor Festus is about to do something that would be rather dangerous for Paul, having Paul sent back to Jerusalem for trial. And then in Acts 25 and 26, we see Paul with the Roman governor Festus, and also with the Jewish king Agrippa, who is ruler of a region outside of this area. And again, Paul uses this opportunity to present the gospel. Well, that's a rather quick tour of some examples. We try to pull together some conclusions. We see, first of all, from the biblical material, that there are limits to state authority, and there are limits to religious authority as well, the authority of priesthood, etc. No humans are given a blank check from God. Okay? This was part of the basis of the reformers during the Reformation, is that they understood from biblical teaching that the Bishop of Rome did not have a blank check either. Huh? The prophets are the closest to ones who have a blank check from God, but they're closely tested, and they have no political power. The authority of religious leaders over political leaders is persuasive and moral only, though sometimes religious leaders have tried to push it further than that. Obedience to God takes precedence. Individuals or groups must obey their own consciousness, their consciences, that is, their understanding of what God requires, but this does not exempt them some political penalties. Leaders have greater responsibilities as they have authority to punish. There is no automatic right to rebel. The disobedience of political religious leaders does not cancel their authority over subordinates, though subordinates may need to disobey in particular points. The case of Ehud back in the Old Testament suggests that rebellion may need explicit revelation, and we have no evidence for a different New Testament ethic here. Well, that's a rather quick tour of the question of how Christians should relate to the state. And we can summarize it best, perhaps, in Jesus' soundbite, "Give Caesar what belongs to Caesar, but give God what belongs to God."